Welcome to Reading the Grid with Aaron and Ina. Each week, we explore the stories behind books, movies, and shows that highlight the history of this dynamic sport. Buckle up for a fast-paced journey through Formula One. Now let's jump into it. We had a spectacular triple crown of motorsport on Sunday. We kicked off with Formula One's Monaco Grand Prix, followed by the 109th running of the Indianapolis 500 in IndyCar, and capped off the day with NASCAR's Coca-Cola 600 at the Charlotte Motor Speedway.
In Monaco, the practice sessions produced exhilarating action, controversies, and grid penalties, and the fight for pole position in qualifying produced thrills like no other. Lando Norris converted pole into victory for his first win of the Monaco Grand Prix de Monaco, but it wasn't a lights to flag affair. Charles Leclerc led the race for a few laps after Norris pitted, with Max Verstappen taking the lead after Leclerc's pit stop on lap 23, gambling on a late red flag or safety car, which never materialized. Despite the new mandatory two-stop rule, the continued inability to overtake meant that Max dropped back to P4 when it was his turn to pit. Norris held off a hard-charging Charles Leclerc and Oscar Piastri to take his second win of the season, tightening the championship fight to just 3 points.
Brake failures, pit lane tension, and tire gambles, Monaco delivered more drama than usual, even if the overtakes stayed scarce. With McLaren pulling further ahead in the constructor standings and the drivers' title race tightening, the championship momentum may be shifting. Ina, who won your heart in Monaco?
Until Q3, in qualifying, it would have been Charles Leclerc, as he built up expectations by winning every practice session, even after his collision with Lance Stroll in FP1 that gave me heart palpitations and flashbacks to his luck deserting him again in Monaco. Even though he pulled off a still impressive P2, it was not enough to match the heights that he reached last year and that he's eager to reclaim again. If we overlook the top three, I would have to say that Esteban Ocon impressed me the most, mostly because he ended up P7 after qualifying P8 in a Haas that had so many problems over the weekend. It was remarkable that Ocon remained in the top 10, even improving his position, mostly due to retirement. His qualifying was impressive, and in Monaco, that is still, even with the changes this year, the session that determines your race.
I'm going to give this to Racing Bulls. I thought Racing Bulls pulled off a strategic play in the Monaco Grand Prix and fully capitalized on the new two-stop rule. They used Liam Lawson to manage the pace and back up the field, although watching it was a bit frustrating. The team created a gap that allowed Isaac Hadjar both of his pit stops without losing track position. He held the lead while Lawson held the pack, and when Lawson finally turned up his own pace and pitted, he rejoined in a strong position, resulting in a career best P6 for Hadjar and Lawson getting his first points of the season at P8. Racing Bulls had their first double points finish and their best result. They had smart teamwork, bold execution, and a perfect adaptation to the new rules that made this a standout moment in Monaco for me.
I just want to add, actually, Hadjar lost position because Hamilton did overtake him during the pit stop shenanigans. I think he didn't lose position that he actually qualified in P6 and was promoted to P5 because of the penalty for Hamilton. But still, I get what you're saying. However, it may be a controversial opinion, but I don't think their strategy was that impressive. It was not new, especially in Monaco, where it is very difficult to overtake. I think what makes it notable is that Lawson finally qualified close enough to Hadjar to make this strategy plausible. I'm sure Red Bull would love to have used a strategy like that, except that Yuki ended up so far behind Max that it wasn't even viable. And both Lawson and Hadjar, as well as their pit crews, executed the strategy Even though Ferrari is a better car, so there's always this expectation that even if they qualify out of position, which they didn't, it was all due to the grid penalty, which we'll get into in a few minutes. But with the fact that Lewis Hamilton was P7, there might have been an expectation that he would still move up on the cars in front of him that were not as good. However, in Monaco, it is very hard to overtake. So the only way you can really move up is the strategy. In this case, Ferrari's strategy ended up being better because Lewis managed to leapfrog Hadjar. I do agree that Racing Bulls were operating at their highest level of the season. I do not think their strategy was really remarkable, and it was just a really good execution.
The strategy itself, it's not groundbreaking, especially in the context of Monaco, where holding up the pack is practically tradition. But it's better than just a good execution because midfield teams have limited opportunities for pulling off a coordinated plan like that under pressure, especially with two relatively inexperienced drivers. Yes, I was wrong. Hadjar didn't hold on to P5, but the double points finish for Racing Bulls, I thought was no small feat. It may not have been revolutionary, but in the context of their season, I thought it was a strategic high point.
I still think it reflects more of how little we think of Racing Bull's capacity for having a good strategy and executing it the way that they're supposed to. In terms of experience, Lawson actually has a lot of experience with Monaco in his junior career and actually won it once, although he was later disqualified. In fact, this is one of his better tracks. So it's not super surprising that he found confidence on a track that everyone says you have to have confidence to have good times, a good experience, because you have to get close to the barriers.
In general, we have not seen good strategy from this team in a very long time, if ever. I also think Hadjar is a really good addition to the team, and maybe it's just his abilities to really do well in this car. But, the fact that they executed something that looked deliberate and even clever, I see that as growth for the team. And I agree, they are downplayed quite a bit. Christian Horner before the race said, they're running their strategy, we're running ours. It just seemed like they made a really good go of it, which was borderline shocking, which does completely back up your point that why is it shocking? It shouldn't be because they're a Formula One team, but the fact that we just haven't seen anything to me was a standout for them because I didn't see that coming going into Monaco, thinking that Racing Bulls would pull that out of their hat.
Exactly. And I also want to say, in terms of Hadjar, it was impressive his evolution from the weekend because, as you know, I love an arc. And his arc was off to a really bad start when he caused two red flags in FP2 by hitting the walls, then getting away with whatever damage he had was able to be repaired so he could go again, and then again hitting the walls. So at that point, I thought, uh-oh. Of all the rookies I thought would have an incident during the race, it would be him. And impressively enough, he got better. Even during his qualifying, his Q1 was so poor, even he said that he barely got out of Q1. And I can attest, I did not think that was going to happen. So the fact that he ended up outqualifying his teammate yet again, and then really doing as well as possible in the race, because again, the fact that he lost position was not really due to him, it was strategy. So I think kudos. Let's hope that they've learned their lesson and they'll continue on this path going forward.
Let's hope. And we can't not congratulate Liam on his first points because he was a good team player. He is not our favorite on the grid. So that's a little difficult to get those words to come out of my mouth, to be honest. But
I almost put him as wooing me, but not enough.
oh, I don't think we're quite to wooing. That would be a stunning turn of events. And I would ask you what's in your coffee if we got to a point where you said Liam was wooing you, Ina. I'd check your temperature. Now we have to talk about who broke our hearts at Monaco, and this one's really hard for me. Toto Wolff, my favorite team principal. Toto and the Mercedes team had a weekend to forget. I am really hoping this is a misunderstanding or some sort of joke, but it's hard to believe that Mercedes completely overlooked the mandatory two stop rule until lap 60.
I was so sure it was a joke, but then it kept appearing in reputable sources. And now I'm very confused because then I think those people should be fired if they've literally forgot.
I mean, I am stunned because this is Toto, and the fact that Toto admitted this, but yet, if Mercedes actually did overlook the mandatory two-stop rule, which is all anyone talked about going into this Grand Prix to begin with. But when you look at lap 60 and Russell and Antonelli were still on their first stint of tires that late in the race, it's really hard to explain it any other way. It seems almost impossible that an entire team could make such a costly and embarrassing error. But if that's true, that has got to go down as one of their biggest strategic missteps. Actually, I did see this was their worst race finish. It was previously held by Michael Schumacher and Nico Rosberg in the 2012 Grand Prix in Texas.
Right. So that's not peak Schumacher or peak Rosberg, obviously.
No.
But I honestly think it was not necessarily an error, as in we just forgot. I think after that qualifying, they just thought there's nothing for us this weekend. And they just threw up their hands, which is not the right attitude and not the attitude I expected Toto to have. It is hard to argue that Mercedes were horrific. They were. But I thought of the two drivers. What happened to Russell was more heartbreaking. Kimi's qualifying position was due to his mistake at the very end of Q1 and his inability to participate in Q2 and to move himself up. They did have do a disaster of a strategy with him, and he ended up the last of the drivers who finished the race. But he created the situation, and there was no way to really salvage it. Russell, on the other hand, he had an engine malfunction that was not his fault. I'm pretty confident that he would have qualified well into the top 10.
Russell is typically a good qualifier. He's been
Typically,
very
but
consistent this year.
he has been. So this was an outlier. Obviously, Mercedes strategies and the team gamemanship with Racing Bull and Williams holding everyone up got to him, and Russell flaunted the rules by cutting the corner, overtaking Albon, and then refusing to give the position back and willing to take the penalty, which of course led to the stewards responding by giving him a harsher penalty. His frustration provided the most excitement we had in the last like 50 laps. And there were also like a lot of post-race exchanges between George and Albon, who are really good friends. It was absolutely abysmal in terms of what George could have expected coming into Monaco and what we could have expected out of George, considering that he has had one of the best seasons in Formula One. Last week, we discussed Brothers in Misfortune. Well, after Monaco, I may have to agree with Alonso. He is the unluckiest man in the world. From the highs of qualifying in P7, which saw him starting in P6 because of, again, the grid penalty for Hamilton, he sounded so happy afterwards. And he said that's why he keeps driving. And this was so refreshing and so wonderful to see. And then everything was undone in the race, which is, I think, what we intend to expect from Aston Martin this year. So the strategy was terrible. So he ended up behind Hamilton and Hedger after the first pit stops. My favorite part was when they told him to start pushing and he just completely went ballistic. Like now, like after I'm behind, I now have to start pushing. And then, of course, his power unit failed. Now, interestingly, Aston is using Mercedes' power unit, which means that the issue that Russell encountered, everyone seems to think that it's due to overheating in qualifying, plagued his buddy Alonso in the race. The fact that Alonso did not finish the race, did not score a point all season, is truly heartbreaking, and this is the worst start of his season to date.
Actually, that is Alonso's worst start since his rookie season.
So pretty much ever.
Pretty much. Scuderia Shenanigans, our dedicated space for all things Ferrari. As current passengers of the Ferrari Hopium train, let's get into every strategic gamble, pit stop panic, and glimmer of Leclerc or Hamilton magic. Because when it comes to the prancing horse, it's never just a race. It's a full-blown emotional saga. Ina, your take on Ferrari's performance at Monaco, because it is your homeboy's home race.
Don't remind me, but the best thing that I can say is that Ferrari had the fastest pit stop for Leclerc. Yay. Also, their strategy was on point. On the one hand, I think they may have been too conservative when they pitted Leclerc, which ensured that he would still be behind Norris. On the other hand, since we know with hindsight that there were no safety cars or red flags, there would have been no better opportunity and may have resulted in him to being in P3, if not lower, if they chose to pit him later. However, I wish they would have done a bolder strategy. But with Piastri and Norris close together, an undercut was not in the cards. In terms of Ferrari in general, they were the reason that Lewis Hamilton got a grid penalty for impeding Verstappen, which I'll leave it to you to unpack. And although they did a great job of moving him from P7 to P5 on strategy, they undercut themselves by not having their drivers closer together so they could have something to destabilize McLaren's. I also am very disappointed in the fact that Lewis ended up 50 seconds slower than the drivers in front of him. I honestly do not know what happened. You cannot blame it on strategy alone. Like, even he was baffled. So that is very disappointing and very worrying for the races to come.
Agreed. Lewis and his race engineer.
Obviously, tensions flared.
At Ferrari during the Monaco Grand Prix, as Lewis Hamilton appeared to struggle with communication from his race engineer, Ricardo Adami. The issues began after Hamilton received a penalty for impeding Max Verstappen. Even Verstappen said he knew this was not Lewis's fault, it was a team error, and Lewis, in his impeccable ability to maintain class, apologized for Verstappen and talked to him after it happened. However, this escalated when his mid-race inquiries about strategy and gaps to the leaders were met with unclear responses. Post-race, Hamilton was heard asking Adami if he was upset with him, but received no reply. This very awkward exchange has raise some eyebrows, but Ferrari team principal Fred Vasseur completely downplayed this situation, which I personally don't like, but I also understand not airing team drama to the media until you get a handle on it.
Surprised he didn't blame the radio, like, because everyone is blaming the radio being not as good in Monaco. There's too much interference, and sometimes they literally can't hear each other. So if I was sir, that's what I would blame the lack of communication on.
Well, I give Visser credit for not placing blame, which then shows me that there is a bigger issue. And I guess he's trying to manage it. But I did see that they talked ahead of time that there would be no radio messages around the tunnel because there is a delay and it's difficult to communicate either direction. Clearly, this incident has sparked discussion about whether there's a deeper disconnect between Hamilton and Adami. I would personally think that a change in engineering support might be needed. Hamilton's adjustment to life in red has not been the smoothest, and this moment underscores how critical clear communication is, especially on these tight streets. This year, Leclerc and Hamilton have had some pretty cheeky messages with their engineers, Hamilton taking the lead if you were to score those out. However, GP and Max. GP still answers Max, even if he doesn't want to. The fact that his race engineer went completely silent, I just don't even know what to say to that. That is such a lack of professionalism, in my opinion.
I think you're right. Either there is some deep disconnect or there is a technical issue because there's no way that should have left unanswered. However, I think it's puzzling that they haven't changed his race engineer because I understand Ferrari operates in a different manner and you kind of work for Ferrari. You don't dictate what Ferrari does, but they spent so much to get Lewis Hamilton into Ferrari. They're so invested in him succeeding. I'm not saying fire his race engineer, but why not make a change and see if something sparks or things fall into place? I mean, I think poor Leclerc had to suffer Javi, his previous engineer, for way too long. And yes, he and Brian, his new engineer, have had growing pains, shall we say. But at the end of the day, it's a much better relationship than whatever is going on with Adami. And I know that science have had issues with him in the past as well. Although, from what I've read, apparently Sebastian Vettel talked to Hamilton before Hamilton went to Ferrari and actually really praised Adami. Vettel speaks Italian, so I don't know if that helped in his relationship.
My guess is Vettel speaking Italian would. And I know Lewis has made an effort to speak Italian, and Ferrari bought a celebrity, and he is a 7-time world champion. And I hate seeing the comments that they overpaid or whatever. I think this is a very interesting year for Hamilton to have switched, given where they are with the car in production and the year. They obviously have designed everything around Charles for a number of years. And I don't think Hamilton came in expecting to be driver number one. He's never had that in his contract. He's always wanted equal treatment. I believe Hamilton will figure it out. It's hard to see all of these struggles, but I think it highlights what's been going on with Ferrari for a very long time, even before Mattia, now with Fred. It goes to much higher up within the team. I think it's under a magnifying glass right now because of the hype that was surrounding Hamilton making the move.
Well, can I just point a few differences? First of all, unless you think Leclerc is full of it, he again, in the interview conducted before the race, said that he and Hamilton have the same driving style, which was not true of him and Sainz. And the car was not always, actually, that was part of the problem, that they kept switching directions because they couldn't choose which driver to listen to. I also don't think Leclerc's driving style is as singular as Max's is, which means no other driver could adapt. And I agree, the issues at Ferrari are obviously way bigger than just what we hear on the radio, what we see in the car. I think there's like a whole cultural issue and barrier in the way of working that might not be working right now. However, I still believe that Hamilton can adjust and do something better, or at least steer the racing portion of the Ferrari machine to operate better and in the way that he likes. And I just think they totally missed the boat with this car. I'm really, really am angry that they changed 95% of it. And as soon as I heard it, I knew it was not going to be a good idea because you don't change this much during the last year of regulations. I do think
No.
he actually made a smart move to move the year before, because 2026 is such a gamble in terms of who's going to come out on top. And if you thought expectation for this year were high, next year it could be even worse. So, and let's not forget, he decided to move because Mercedes were not willing to commit to him for as long as he wanted, and to have him as an ambassador, which I think is ridiculous. So he was looking for something that would continue post-racing career, and Ferrari offered him that, and it's really hard to see who would ever turn that down.
I think Mercedes, and I love you, Toto Wolff, but those are two pretty significant and costly missteps. Missing the boat on the mandatory 2-pit stop and not giving Lewis Hamilton the ambassador opportunity. I saw Charles' quote that they have very similar driving styles, and there's a lot that he's learned from Lewis, and at times he will use certain things deemed appropriately when he thinks that'll have a benefit within the race. I go back to what Brundle said, where it's almost better to be a rookie learning than to unprogram 12 years. So there is plenty of this on Lewis's shoulders, which from everything I've seen or heard, he is working extremely hard to work through. Fred needs to figure out if this is the right fit for race engineering, because it's clearly not working. We're going to talk about the Spanish Grand Prix in our next episode, and this would be the last race that they bring any upgrade too. So it could be a really painful remainder of the season. But let's get back to Monaco.
Not everything happens in the front of the pack. We shine a light on the teams fighting it out in the most competitive part of the grid. From surprising strategy plays to quiet consistency, we break down who's punching above their weight and who's getting lost in the shuffle. Because sometimes the best racing isn't necessarily for P1. Aaron, let's read the grid. And how about we start with Williams?
They tried to mimic the V-carb strategy, but why they pitted Albon when Lawson did, I will never understand. However, Williams pulled off a smart and somewhat controversial strategy in Monaco using teamwork between Albon and Sainz to secure a double points finish. The team carefully coordinated their pit windows. You know, James Vowles is very specific, and there were a number of people joking that you would need a calendar to be able to pull this off. So Sainz slowed the pack to give Albon space for his stops, and Albon later returned the favor by holding up rivals so Sainz could pit without losing track position.
The plan paid off, landing both drivers in the points. However, the strategy drew criticism from other teams who viewed it as overly manipulative, which I think is ridiculous. How is it manipulative? Not
Sounds like jealousy to me.
exactly. Not only is it exactly the same as what V-Carb or Racing Bulls executed and have been praised for, but Mercedes did exactly the same strategy when they finally realized they had to pit Russell. I did not like that James Vowles and Alex Albon were apologetic afterwards. They have nothing to apologize for. They made the best with the strategies they had, and every team should strive to be in this position. For Williams, it marked a major success in a season where every point counts.
I agree. I did see where Toto said that James Vowles, a former Mercedes engineer, texted him in the race with, "And I'm sorry." And I don't think he needed to do that.
And I hated it because it still showed him kind of subservient to Toto. And I
Yeah.
think somebody had to put Toto in his place and say, look, if I were in Mercedes, I would not let whatever the hell you let happen with your strategies happen.
Nope.
And that's the way, yes, when people asked for two stop race, I don't think this strategy is what they thought of. But they should have. Again, this was a fact not just in Monaco, in many other races. And they should have anticipated that teams were going to go for it if they're qualified close enough.
Yeah, I agree, but I have to ask a question. So you praised Williams for doing the same strategy, but were not as complimentary as the Racing Bulls. How come?
I did not praise them. I actually don't think either deserve praise. But Williams' strategy has been on point throughout the season. Like they have not dropped the ball, and they did the best they could to protect the points that they thought they could get in Monaco. And actually, I would say Racing Bulls executed it better and earlier, but they should definitely not apologize for it.
Well, Racing Bulls definitely didn't apologize. How about Haas?
Well, this was a tale of two halves. During free practices, Haas looked weak, with Behrman seemingly marginally better than Ocon. All of this was undone by the most brain-dead moment in FP2 that I have seen, and unfortunately had to do with Behrman. He did not slow down during a red flag, overtook Sainz, and he justified this to the steward that he thought it would be safer to overtake. Which is laughable. And the penalty that he received was anything but. It was a 10-place grid drop. I think it was very well deserved because this time he definitely saw the red flag. He proceeded to ignore it, and he really didn't have a good excuse. It actually didn't matter where he qualified, since the penalty ensured he would be at the back of the grid, but he managed to go out in Q1 and started P20th. Even though another driver who qualified P19 got two separate grid penalties. Ocon, on the other hand, came alive in qualifying, securing P8, ended up P7 in the race, and this was an incredible achievement because Haas did it all wrong. Even before the race started, they managed to leave a cooling fan on Bearman's car as he left the garage. Then they had to retrieve it. I'm not sure if he was on the formation lap, but he was already on the grid. And they literally had to send out a mechanic to take out the cooling fan, which was not allowed. And thankfully, they only got hit with a penalty and not another grid drop.
That was a fine, not a penalty.
And not to be outdone, during one of Bearman's pit stops, they did not have his tires ready. And that cost him a lot of time. Ultimately, he ended up P12. But that was mostly due to other teams having horrible strategies.
Haas's leadership under Ayo Komatsu is starting to face real scrutiny, as it should. The car has lacked pace, their race strategies have been consistently underwhelming. And often reactive rather than proactive, while Esteban and Ollie have shown flashes of promise and may ultimately prove a more balanced, forward-looking pairing than Hülkenberg and Magnussen, it's unclear if they have the tools to hold on to sixth in the constructors. Unless the team turns things around soon, questions about Komatsu's future will only grow louder.
I just want to say, I don't think they're a balanced duo. In fact, I think they're both inconsistent, which is an issue. I was hoping that with Ocon's experience, at least his side of the garage could be consistently, certain places, but he's been so up and down. It's as bad as Bierman, who's been qualifying P20th, like it seems for the entire season. I know there were times he was in Q3, but honestly, I can't even remember when the last time he did that.
I'm gonna say that has a lot to do with the car and what they're working with.
I don't know. I heard that Bearman was very inconsistent in F2, and the excuse at that time was, well, focus was on F1. He was constantly called up to take place of a driver who was out for one reason or another. So with the split focus, you cannot expect him to be that consistent.
Yeah, I
I
can see
think,
how I can see that.
but obviously he's a rookie, so he
Yeah.
might balance out. But right now, too many ups and downs with him.
Well, another down was Pierre Gasly at Alpine. He did not end up on pole, as I boldly predicted, nor did he end up in eighth, as we each hoped. Instead, his back gear axles locked up. He ran into Yuki Tsunoda and then blocked the pit lane, preventing anyone from getting a quote unquote free pit stop from the safety car flag to clean up the debris.
Well, it was virtual safety car, which I call shenanigans on the race control because they should have made it a safety car. And this was very sobering because until this race, I believe Gasly finished every Monaco Grand Prix he participated. And he was always very good around here. And last year, his teammate and frenemy, Esteban Ocon, collided with him on lap one, which caused Ocon to be out of the race and out of the team, as this was the straw that broke the camel's back for Alpine. The roles seem to have been reversed, with Gasly trying for a move with Yuki Tsunoda, his former teammate and bestie, and then he tried to blame Yuki for the incident. Although the prevailing wisdom is that Flavio Briatore insisted on this narrative, and I tend to believe it. By the way, Franco Colapinto did not crash.
If you were going to go for wooing, I would have thought you would have gone for that situation instead of Liam.
He really did nothing. Like for practices, at one practice, I don't know, I think it was more than one, but definitely on one practice, he was a second behind the car in P19. I
But
mean, he
he
was
didn't
woefully horrible.
crash.
Yes, but then listen, we can
Low
also
bar,
go
Ina. Low
very
bar.
slowly in an F1 car and not crash. That does not make us F1 drivers.
No, you and I could do that. Racing Bulls, we already covered, but we should note that after this weekend's performance with both drivers finishing in the points, the Visa Cash App Racing Bulls are only 4 points behind Haas, making the midfield of the constructors' title a bit more interesting. Aston Martin, a team that came into Monaco with a lot of intrigue and left with mixed results. We already talked about how Fernando Alonso looked solid in qualifying. Unfortunately, it didn't last. He retired with an engine issue, which was not the outcome the team was hoping for, although I did get a kick out of the fact and felt like this was an FU to the rest of the grid of how Alonso positioned his car where it would not require a safety car, so no one would be able to capitalize on a free pit stop.
Why do you think he broke my heart?
I know.
Because at least he could have provided some entertainment. Although I believe at that point it would probably mostly benefit Max. So I'm okay that it didn't happen.
Agreed.
While Alonso's DNF was a blow, Lance Stroll did manage to finish in the top 15. This is despite the fact that Lance Stroll was the person I mentioned earlier who got two separate grid penalties. One for causing the collision with Leclerc in FP1, and that was for one place, and one for impeding Pierre Gasly in qualifying, which cost them 3 place grid drop. And his excuse for that was great. He confused Hamilton's car with Gasly's car. Now, Hamilton's car is red, Gasly's is pink. I'm wondering, and he claimed the sun made him unable to distinguish the two. Which is great. My favorite part of reading the steward's decision to give him the 3 place grid penalties, they believe that excuse because, like, yep, sounds plausible enough. So his concentration was atrocious. And I honestly thought something's going to happen. If it's not lap one, lap 15, at some lap, his concentration is going to go and we're going to get a crash. So it's pretty remarkable that he kept it together. So there were no major fireworks from him during the race. But at a circuit like Monaco, where overtaking is nearly impossible, just keeping it clean and finishing can sometimes be a small win. And I have to say, there were only two overtakes. He did the last one. He overtook Hülkenberg on the last lap.
Are you counting where Carlos gave the position back as an overtake?
No, I'm counting when Bartoletto overtook Antonelli.
Oh, and then
Antonelli decided to overtake Bartoletto, and Bartoletto ran into the
what?
wall.
That's yes. Well,
So that's the overtake I remember. And the
yep.
second one, they didn't even show it live, but
No.
he eventually overtook Hülkenberg on the last lap. So I'm going to give him that win.
That's a win. I mean, that's not wooing status win. You know,
But it's a
it's been
win.
a while since Lance has wooed me, but you know, on any other race, that might have gotten him up there. Off track, though, Aston Martin was making quite the statement. They debuted the Valhalla, their high performance supercar, in its first public appearance. It definitely added some extra shine to the Monaco weekend, which was already pretty glitzy.
And let's not forget the presence of the designer to the stars, designer extraordinaire, Adrian Newey, who was trackside for Aston Martin for the first time. His arrival already stirred a lot of excitement, and this weekend gave fans a glimpse of what's to come as the team looks to evolve and build for the future. He had also a very revealing interview. He, with respect to Max possibly joining Aston Martin in the near future, he said very astutely that first, Max would need to see that they have the best car. And remember, Adrian Newey knows Max because he was at Red Bull for so many years and during all the winning years that Max won the world championship. He also said that their tools are weak. And no, he was not referring to Lance Stroll. He specified that their driver in the loop simulator is not where it needs to be, and it may be 2 years before it's properly correlated. I honestly thought Alonso's heart probably died when he heard that because he already said 2026 was going to be his last year, and I'm sure he was expecting some new magic for that car. He was also observed inspecting the McLarens, who wouldn't take that chance, and talking with Christian Horner, his former boss. Which is intriguing, but I
Good
don't know if
day.
it means anything.
Well, I don't know. You never know. It could. But a weekend that was a little frustrating on the racing side was full of forward-looking momentum. Aston hinted at bigger moves on the horizon. Now we come to one of my favorite sections. Let time to spill the grid, Ina. Let's dish out all the off-track drama, spicy team radio moments, and behind-the-scenes chaos that makes Formula One more than just a race. Kyle Larson stirred debate by claiming he's a better, quote unquote, all-around driver than F1 champion Max Verstappen, pointing to his success across various racing formulas like dirt tracks, sprint cars, and NASCAR. While Larson admitted he likely couldn't win Monaco, he suggested Verstappen wouldn't win in his world either. Verstappen responded respectfully, acknowledging Larson's versatility, but brushing off the comparison, noting that each racing discipline requires its own skill set. The exchange reignites the age-old debate: is the best driver the one who dominates a single discipline, or the one who can master many?
Yeah, I think master is the main word here because, correct me if I'm wrong, but Kyle Larson tried to do, is it called the Ironman?
The Iron Man, where you
The
do the
Ironman,
IndyCar and
which,
NASCAR in the same day. Yes, that's
yes,
correct.
to participate in IndyCar and NASCAR on the same day. He flamed out in IndyCar. I don't believe he made much traction in NASCAR. So that was not mastery that he was talking about. I think. Obviously, different series have different skill sets, so it's very hard to compare. But until Kyle Larson dominates in the way that Max Verstappen in all aspects of any part of any series, I think it's laughable to compare him to Max Verstappen. I honestly think that nobody has that level of concentration and singular focus like Max, and nobody makes as few mistakes as Max. So just those qualities alone make me think that he could master other series if he was so inclined, and he may still have time to do that. But speaking of, again, invoking Max Verstappen, there was a funny thing that happened in F2, not what happened in track, but there was a huge incident in turn one, lap one, where the pole sitter who was momentarily overtaken plowed into the driver who tried to overtake him and took out seven cars in the process. And a couple of drivers were talking, and one of them asked, like, what happened? And the other one said, well, he thought he was Max Verstappen. And it's hilarious to see the debate, like what it meant. And everyone obviously realized that it meant, well, he thought he was Max Verstappen, but he wasn't. And his move, which I think was trying to emulate what Max did at Imola, obviously did not
Fell short.
work, but just a tiny bit,
Just a tiny
which
bit.
just shows you that, as all masters do, Max makes it look easy, but it's not that easy to reproduce.
No, that's when you know you are really, really, really good at something when you make it look that easy. Speaking of Max and other formulas, we had the F1 movie private screening in Monaco, but Franz Herrmann, I mean Max Verstappen, decided to stay at home because he travels and is often away from home and decided to iRace instead.
Said he wanted to spend time with his family, but that's what I'm saying. He's so
iRacing
into.
isn't spending time with your family, that's just being home.
My point is, for him, iRacing is like part of his being. But the reactions to the movie were interesting. I guess my favorite exchange was when Albon was asked of his takeaways, and he said, "Ask Max." I think he was joking, but it was very telling. Kimi apparently thought it was too long, and Sainz expressed his view that this is for people who don't know much about F1, which was very worrying. The rest were very diplomatic with very canned answers. However, Ocon's excitement seemed very genuine, and I honestly believe he might have really liked it.
Well, I guess you and I will find out since we're going to go see it in theaters on June 27th and we'll report back.
We will. Lewis Hamilton said like he wanted their reactions in terms of how do the racing scenes look? Do they look authentic? Does it look like feels for them when they are in the car? And although he claimed that everyone responded to him directly with all positives, it seemed some of the reactions were more muted than if you just listen to what Lewis said. So we will find out, but it kind of gives you an interesting perspective of what this movie could be.
We'll wrap up with a very cute follow-up to the whole Russell Albon exchange and the fact that Russell said he was having dinner with Albon and Albon was going to get the check, and Albon delivered. They posted a very friendly image of the two of them with Alex paying the tab.
Yeah, it was very cute. It was funny because he was, I think it was a post where he was reflecting on his race and just like, Albon owned him a dinner tab. And then Albon, of course, had to be cheeky and said, okay, see you at the drive-thru. So I think some people were disappointed that it didn't go to the drive-thru, which I honestly can't imagine Russell at. But yeah, it was a very cute response. And I knew Russell's frustration during the race wasn't aimed at Albon. It's mostly the situation he was in.
Yeah, well, a lot of the commentary I've heard about the two stop is that it was either overhyped or they need to make tweaks for next year, saying that one of the stops has to come within the first 20 laps. So we'll see how the aftermath of the mandatory two stop, where the dust settles on it. But I do applaud in general the FIA for trying to do something to make the race more interesting. It did not quite execute that way, but at least they tried, because I would hate for the decision to come down to scrap Monaco as a race, because it's really just not conducive for the cars of today.
Yeah, and I think Monaco has a contract through 2031, which is good because all the practices and qualifying were better than the race, but also the practices were more interesting than practices are usually. Like something riveting was happening every few minutes.
That's fair.
So I think it's still worth it to keep it as a race. I agree they have to do something. I think two stop was not a bad idea. Obviously, they have to spend more
Make some
time.
tweaks in execution and the rules or qualifications, give them
But
some
I do have to
parameters.
say one thing that I thought was very confusing is keeping track, especially in the first like few laps, who pitted, who had how many pit stops left. Like the broadcasters got confused. I got confused. It feels like you needed like a spreadsheet to keep it all in mind. So that part was a little confusing, but it's still better than what we had last year, even though I loved the result last year. Let's repeat it next year. But it was a procession.
I applaud that they tried something new and the fact that they recognize something needs to be done to bring some excitement. And people are talking about it in a whole new way. And whatever the new regulations are or the edits to the two stop, let's hope someone actually gets the memo to Mercedes for next year.
Yes.
Disney and F1 are putting together a collaboration that is coming in 2026. We saw Romain Grosjean standing by Mickey and the F1 car, which I will say that now we have a better understanding of the penalties that were inflicted on drivers for cursing. I can only imagine what this branded contract looks like, since F1, I'm assuming, will have to align with Disney's brand. And I will be very curious to see how this plays out for Christian Horner and the drama surrounding him and his former assistant.
Well, Disney has the same issue, I think, as most other big companies, and that's hypocrisy. So, as long as it makes money, I think they could look the other way. And especially with Christian Horner, because his scandal is way, way, way on the back burner of everything that's going on with F1. I mean, if they were that conscious about their brand, Flavio Briatore is on the grid with all his issues. Like, there are so many questionable characters in F1. So, if Disney decided to partner, I think they were willing to make concessions to make sure the money was coming. Well, that's a wrap on the 2025 Monaco Grand Prix, a race that gave us strategy surprises, radio drama, and great teamwork. While overtakes were scarce, tension was sky high with the new two-stop rule shaking up the status quo, but maybe not in the way everyone intended. From a stop late gamble to Ferrari's communication breakdown and Racing Bulls pulling off their best results yet, Monaco delivered a classic in its own glamorous way. We'll be watching closely to see how these storylines carry into the next race, which happens to be next weekend in Barcelona, the third race of this triple header.
Thanks so much for hanging out with us. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to hit the subscribe button so you never miss an update.
Would also love to hear from you, whether it's your thoughts on today's episodes, your suggestions for F1 books, shows, or movies to explore, or a shout out to a buddy who will pick up the dinner tab. Connect with us on Instagram, YouTube, or X, or drop us an email at readingthegrid@gmail.com. We want your ideas to fuel this podcast, so don't be shy.
Thanks for joining us on Reading the Grid. Keep your engines running and your pages turning. Until next time.